Tales from the Dark Pool is funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.
Geogwitch, also Falter, good Tales from the Dark Pool. I'm Adam Corr.
And I'm Megan Everiniela.
And we'll be presenting today's programme.
As always, we have a jam-packed programme lined up for you.
Well, let's get started then.
We're making our way to the Candy Village via Holy Faith Cluster for a really sweet story.
What a Wonderful World by Alex Martin. My dream is about this world where I was in charge. Everyone listened to me. I lived in the Candy Village. In the Candy Village, the snow was dip-dab and I never wanted to wake up from my world. But everyone has to wake up from their dreams. I always loved going to bed to go into my dream world. I loved it here. I had amazing friends and life was great. In the real world, I didn't have many friends and everyone just thought of me as that weird quiet girl that sits down the back in the corner. But in my world, everyone thought of me as a cool outgoing girl who was fun. I felt like a princess in my world. Tonight I was going to try to go to sleep early because I would have more time there, but I couldn't sleep. I was so excited to see what I was going to do. I tried nearly everything by drinking warm milk and reading a book. Nothing was working. I decided to give up. I turned on the telly and jumped into bed, and then all of a sudden I was in my Candy Village, in my jelly bed. I got out of bed and went down to where the lollipop girls sit, and I joined them for breakfast. They all were so happy to see me. I felt so happy because I had a miserable day. We had breakfast and went outside to the melted chocolate pool. I went straight onto the slide and I went headfirst into the melted chocolate. The lollipop girls were looking into the candy cane forest. There was a family of Oreos walking in. Only people leaving the town go through there. No one was supposed to leave without permission. I ran over to them covered in chocolate. "Hey, where are you going?" I shouted. They turned back. I walked over. "Where are you going?" I asked. The leader of the Oreos replied, "We were kicked out of the Milky Mountain." "Kicked out? What do you mean?" I asked. A little girl walked up to me. A crazy Mento man came in and had an army of Mentos with him and said he wants Milky Mountain for himself. I was very angry now. "Where is he?" I said. "He's in the Milky Mountain castle. You're not leaving. We're going back to bring Mento man back to Kola Volcano where he's supposed to be, okay?" All the Mentos smiled. As we walked up to Milky Mountain, the Oreos were singing a song. It had a good beat, so I joined them. When we arrived at Milky Mountain Castle, there was a Mento guard at the gate. I told the Oreos they have to wait outside. I walked up to the gate. "Hey, I have to see Mento Man. He wanted me." The guards opened the gate and let me in. They were really stupid as Mento Man never wanted to see me. I walked to the castle door and walked straight in, screamed, "Mento Man." I heard a reply. "I'm in the kitchen." I walked into the kitchen to find Mento Man lying on the table eating a jar of mint. "Why are you here?" he asked. "I was looking for the Oreos. They have left and decided to move to the city. They gave the castle to me," he said. I laughed. "Do you really think I would believe you? I walked from the candy cane forest with the Oreos back here to get their castle." He just stood there in silence. "So are you going to go back to Cola Mountain?" I said. He replied, "Yes, I will, but please tell the Oreos I'm really sorry. It's just I wanted a new place. There is nothing to do at Cola Mountain." I didn't think he knew he could come out every day. "Did you not know you could come out to me and the lollipop girls?" He had a huge smile on his face. "Really, you would want me to come out?" he said. "Yeah, you could come out tomorrow," I said. He nodded his head and skipped out the door. I walked out to the Oreos and told them the good news. The little girl ran up to me and hugged me and said thanks and ran into the castle. But then sadly, I woke up. My alarm was going off. It was 6:47, time to get ready for school. While I was brushing my hair, I thought of how nice I was to the crazy Mento man and smiled and said to myself, "You did something good today. Everything good happens in my wonderful world."
Would you like to swim in a chocolate lake, Megan?
Duh, of course. It's been a dream of mine for years.
We're off to Merrifield College for a mini thriller.
The headline said by Alva McCaughey. She walked in the forests looking at her surroundings. It was a windy day, the green leaves on the trees flowing with the wind. Many things were on her mind, and to be kept hidden was definitely one of them, as were cameras everywhere. She kept her hood well up, covering most of her face, and walked out into a clearing. She unzipped the bag that was on her back, put it on the grassy earth. She took up many newspapers. All the headlines said the same thing, "Wanted." It was a normal day for Roscoe. He opened the door to his house. It had been the usual for him at school, except for the wide chatter that a girl his age had stolen government files about mission plans and army weapons. But it was such a far-fetched story that a five-year-old could have made it up. He did not believe it. He sat on his couch, taking the black and grey remote in his hands and turning on the TV. On the screen was a girl with long ruby red curly hair and emerald green eyes. She was extremely pale and skinny. He wondered how such a girl could afford a computer, let alone steal government files. The headline said "Wanted," but that didn't catch his eye. It was the information about where she was last seen that caught his attention. He went out to the kitchen to grab his bike keys and headed off. Police Officer O'Connell was not happy with his department. They had almost grabbed the girl this time, but as usual, she slipped through their fingers like water. He didn't see how hard it could be to find a girl with bright emerald eyes and big red curly hair. But then again, maybe it was considering he was the head of the department and not in the field. He walked over to his wooden desk and opened one of the drawers. Inside was the file against the girl. It was the same picture they used for the news, except it was more scraped up. He grabbed the paper out of the file and looked at all the information. Name: Esther Loycraft. Date of birth: 12th of July 2000. Subject: QR18362154. Crime: stolen government files. Life: born in LAB, landing advanced base. He was astonished at how little information the file had given him. Surely there would be more for him, but as he looked, there was nothing else. She was on the run again. The police had almost gotten her again, but she was just able to slip through. The wind had picked up since she last travelled, and it started to rain. She ran through the massive forest, her hair whipping behind her. She turned to look up at where the sun is to direct her to true north, but the rain clouds were in the sky so she couldn't tell for now. She decided to climb a tree and let the rain pass. She grabbed many branches as she climbed, being sure not to fall. She made it to a branch wide and sturdy enough to lie on. She took her bag off her back and planned escape routes if the police came, but for now, she was safe. Roscoe was cycling as hard as he could, the rain splashing in his face. It had only started as a drizzle when he left his house, but now it was a full-on uproar. He had made sure to go a different way than the police, otherwise he would have to come up with an excuse, and he was horrible at lying. He had made perfect time and was sure that she would still be there if he looked hard enough. Police Officer O'Connell was pacing in his office. He was getting many town complaint calls saying that the power was out. In fact, nearly the whole town had lost power, and they were not able to do anything. The only place still on was the police station, but that was thanks to the government. O'Connell was sure that the station would lose power soon too, so he dispatched all on-field officers to go down to the forest. She was not going to get away so easy this time. Roscoe cycled into a big tree area and saw a girl. It was the girl. He tried to contain his excitement, but as he moved twigs, they broke, and she turned around to see what was the noise. She was definitely surprised to see a boy her age jumping around like an idiot. Roscoe quickly cleaned himself off, turning to face her with an embarrassed look on his face. He rubbed the back of his neck awkwardly. "What do you want?" she spat. He walked towards her. "Are you really that dense?" he questioned. "If you're trying to flatter me, it's not working," she said, crossing her arms. Roscoe was going to have to word his sentences very carefully so that she wouldn't run off. "I'm going to offer you something that you probably really need right now, okay?" She stared at him, but let him continue. "I'm offering you a place to stay, and I promise I won't tell my parents." She looked at him in shock. Finally, she managed to get something out. "How can I trust you? You remind me of someone. I just don't know who, and something about this doesn't seem right," he said. In the distance, they could hear dogs. She stared at him one more time, and without knowing why, she said, "All right, I'll come with you. But if you turn me in, you know what I can do."
It's all very creative so far.
And we're going to keep it that way with our first poem.
We're stepping outdoors with this one, a poem by Cathal O'Reilly. "Spring is tomorrow, and everyone will cheer. It always ends in May. It's the best time of the year, except for Christmas Day. The sun is bright, on the grass I lay. Children are having fun. The flowers are blossoming more and more each day. Everyone runs around in the sun. How can anyone be sad on this beautiful morning? When the season ends, it's bad. It leaves without a warning. Praise the morning and the sun. The first day of spring has begun."
The Horror Home by Jason Hyland in the Donaghy's Community School. As I walked up to the garden, I began to regret, but I opened the door and saw the mirror reflect. I closed the door and loudly it squeaked, and so did the floorboards, so I started to freak. "Hello," I yelled, with a lump in my throat. I then saw a statue that started to float. "Are you a ghost?" I whimpered with a tear in my eye. The floor collapsed. "Oh no," I cried. A man with a chainsaw jumped through the wall. I screamed and ran, tried not to fall. I kicked the door down, and off I ran. "Don't go in there. No, never again."
Now we have a story from Art School LaSalle on a very current and important issue facing society today.
"We Must Take Action Against Global Warming" by Jane Gaffey. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to talk to you today about the world issue that affects and is affecting every person listening, global warming. I am sure that you have all heard about this issue before, many times, but I am here to explain to you just how serious the issue of global warming really is, and also what each of us can do to help out. Polar ice caps are shrinking 9% every year. If this continues, the future generations, your children and grandchildren, will be living underwater. Polar bears and other species are dying out at a rapid rate. You could be joining them. The world is pretty much collapsing around us, but don't lose faith. Together we can stop global warming. It will not be easy, but it is certainly possible. Each person in this room can do something to help bring an end to this monster that is plaguing our beautiful planet. So join me, my friends. I urge you to make a change. The planet and your children's futures depend on your choices. Help save the planet Earth before it is too late. The planet is constantly changing, constantly evolving. Remember when the continents were all one? Me neither, but it was like that, but at some stage in time. Change is part of us humans. Change keeps the world going, but it is the pace of our change in our planet that is causing sea levels to rise, temperatures to escalate, and causing species to go extinct at a rate never seen before. Average temperatures have increased by 0.8 degrees Celsius around the world since 1880. Much of this in recent decades. You may be thinking, that's not so bad, it means more trips to the beach or strolls into Dublin City. Well, I'm sorry to burst your bubble, but the beach will be swallowed by the ocean and Dublin City will be underwater unless we change. You'd better learn how to swim. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports that 11 out of the past 12 years are the warmest since 1850. The 20th century's last two decades were the hottest for 400 years. If we don't do anything to help our planet, things will only get worse. Could you imagine swimming alone in an ice-cold ocean for hours on end, starving, never knowing when you'll be able to take another step on land, if you ever make it to land, never knowing where your children are, not even knowing if your children are alive? For polar bears, this is the reality. Did you know that by around 2040, two-thirds of our polar bears will be gone? That is, if we continue down this very slippery slope into total environmental chaos. Looking at a picture of a polar bear will be to your grandchildren what looking at a picture of a dinosaur is to us. But polar bears are not the only species under serious threat. Studies have shown that one quarter of the Earth's species could be headed for extinction by 2050. That means over 1 million species obliterated in the next 50 years because of global warming. This is a very real but preventable issue. Not only is the Earth at serious risk with ice caps melting and sea levels rising, we are also at risk of extreme weather events such as hurricanes and storms. In the early 2000s, the first ever hurricanes occurred in Brazil. This is strongly linked to global warming, as are other devastating global disasters like Hurricane Katrina, which in 2005 left a once spectacular New Orleans an underwater wreck. The melting of the ice caps is disrupting the Earth's ocean circulation system, meaning that there is a chance the North Atlantic Drift may stop working. The whole of Ireland would be turned into an ice cube. I know this all sounds very doom and gloom, but do not be discouraged. Every single person listening has the power to make a huge difference and save our planet. Every single person listening could become superheroes if you give yourself the chance. We don't have to do anything extreme, nothing that drastically disrupts your normal lifestyle. Just simple habits that are small but gravely important. Turn off your electrical items when you're finished using them. Walk, cycle, or take the bus instead of your car. Even turning the tap off while you're brushing your teeth makes a difference. Don't let giant money-grabbing worldwide corporations tell you otherwise. Global warming is very real, but also very preventable, with a little bit of teamwork. It's us. Team human race against a monster that is global warming. I urge you to continue today with a mission to stop global warming. I urge you to walk wherever you're going instead of using that carbon dioxide emitting machine that we like to call a car. I urge you to put your cans, plastics and papers in the recycling bin. It's really not very difficult. I urge you not only to do this for yourself and your future, I urge you to do this for the livelihood of your children. For why do they deserve a world beyond repair?
Global warming poses a very serious threat to the world.
It certainly does.
Let's take some more poems. This one comes from School Katrina. The Journey of Marriage, in response to Paul Durkin's The Difficulty That Is Marriage. Clashes and cold shoulders, I shiver and wrap the bedclothes around me, as I set off on a train of thought while you stay at the station, unaware that my conscience welcomes me on board. We navigate around trees with bowling branches, loaded with questions in full bloom. The route is a circle that goes on for a lifetime. I have returned to your side. I lay eyes on your face. It is smooth, except for your furrowed brows. A sign that you are lost in the woods of reflection. I would give you a map if I could find you.
Listen to this one from Manor House, No Man's Land by A.W. My grandpa told me about the trenches and the land in between. One day I asked, what is it called? No man's land, he said. The worst place I have ever been. Up the ladder, boys, the captain would say. Good luck to you all and come back safe. On the count of three, we all charged, firing our guns and praying hard. Crawling in the mud, we tried to make it to the trench to claim victory to this land and send the Hun away. When the war was over, I was given a medal of bravery. My father said to me, it runs in my side of the family. My grandpa told me about the trenches and the land in between. One day I asked him, what is it called? No man's land, he said. The worst place I have ever been. Back to our stories now.
16 and Pregnant by Sophie McLaughlin. What's up, I'm Sophie and this is my story about having an unplanned pregnancy and being ditched by me fella. This is how the story went. So I've been talking to this fella Anto a while on Facebook and Snapchat, you know yourself. All started when I liked his liking on ChatU and he gave me the What's Up X. I was chuffed out in me box. Anyways, we've been talking and talking as you do. He's a nice young fella all the same, bang on, you get me drift. It took me a while to decide whether to go out to him or not. It was a hard decision to make because all the youngsters these days are the same, using the beauty. So I finally made the decision and I went out even though my stomach was doing backflips. Of course he made me get 17A up the cool octopus gaff, as all fellas say, free gaff there you're floating. Have to say it was worth the hike. So after being going out to him for a few months and not doing anything with him, I was surprised he still wanted to see me. But then of course one of the nights watching Netflix and chilling, things got a bit out of hand. Makes me sick to think of it, to be honest. Not gonna get into much detail as I'm sure you already know what went on. Anyway, everything was grand till a few weeks later. I kept feeling sick and not feeling myself. I was starting to get worried, if you want to put it in that way. So the days went on and I was feeling even worse. It got to the point where I woke up during the night getting sick. I told the girls in the Facebook group chat about what happened that night with me and Anto and what was happening to me and how I was feeling. Chantelle the mad cow said to me, you could be pregnant, get a clear blue test. I told her to go away, that there was no way I was pregnant at all. So a week later I finally went to my local chemist and got a pregnancy test. To say I was gigging myself is an understatement. I went into the pub next door and done the pregnancy test. 10 minutes later the results came up, I was pregnant. I don't think I ever cried so much in my life. The only thing that was going through my head was how I was going to tell my ma, she'd bait me around the gaff. So I had to go home and tell her I couldn't keep it in. You don't even want to know what happened when I did tell her. After I told my ma, I had to let Anto know. So I rang him, I felt sick to my stomach. When he answered, he was with all the boys and I told him to get tell around to his gaff. Now that I had something serious to tell him, poor young fella must have shrapped himself. He was around in his gaff and rang me back in about 2.2 seconds. Anyways, I told him what happened. He didn't care and told me not to ring him again, that he doesn't want anything got to do with me or the child, the dirty scumbag. I was heartbroken. I really did think he was the one and that he would be supportive. 9 months later, me and my baby Jacob were doing just fine without the Muppet. I had my friends and family, that's all I needed around me, and my baby Jacob turned one and I still hadn't heard a word from his outfit. Sure didn't surprise me anyway. I don't regret having Jacob Bumby. It was the best thing that ever happened to me, though I was 16 and still had my whole life ahead of me. Anyways, that's my story on how I got pregnant at such a young age. It was a good and bad experience all in one, but at the end of the day, I wouldn't know what I'd do without Jacob. He's changed me in so many ways. Anyways, kiddos, always use protection.
There are a lot of astute observational stories and poems in this series. I like this poem by Leah O'Brien.
Like father, like son. She was used to it by now, after many nights alone, but she always ended up hoping and calling on his phone. He would come home late at night, smelling strongly of beer. But how she complained, it happens year after year. Her granddad was an alcoholic before he swallowed the gun. But you know what they say, like father, like son. After all the pain he caused, one thing sure was clear. No time soon would he be winning Father of the Year. Our last poem today is The Fantastic Masquerade by Megan Whelan. Teenage life is nothing more than a masquerade, hiding our true selves with the latest makeup brands, covering our imperfections, hiding our flaws. Your lips aren't big enough, out with the pencil she draws. Clothed in lack of confidence, a million thoughts running through our minds. Not tall enough, not skinny enough, not pretty enough. True beauty comes from within, yet instead we are juggling for perfection, dying for attention, and pining for acceptance. Accept your body. Accept it. Even if it doesn't look like the photoshopped models. Accept your clothing style. Accept it. Even if it doesn't fit into the latest categories. But most importantly, remove your mask and accept yourself.
Ladies and gentlemen, fasten your seatbelt for today's feature story. It is written by Sean Fulham, a pupil at Mount Temple.
Twice killed, twice died by Sean Fulham. I am dying. You stand above me as I lie in the grass. The smell of flowers that I cannot name surrounding us. A sadistic smile on your face. I stare into your eyes. I see no remorse. You lean forward and close my eyelids. You have killed me. My name is Dermot O'Neill and I died on a Thursday. There is nothing unusual about this particular Thursday except that I am driving to pick you up, my brother, from prison. As I came off the M11 and drive down a run-down road into the prison compound, it begins to rain. The compound itself is a grey building, no discernible features besides a bright yellow door and it being surrounded by acres of forests. I get on my BMW i8, pull up my hood and begin to wait. Just as I consider getting back into my car to avoid the rain, the yellow door opens and you walk out. You are a tall man with black hair and bright blue eyes. You stop, your eyes searching for me, your ticket of freedom. You finally see me and your eyes widen ever so slightly. You begin to walk over, a smirk playing across your face. You walk slowly, measuring your footsteps, your leather shoes tapping out a rhythm on the pebbles. When you reach me, we open our arms and hug. You're still wearing the suits, I say, smirking. I step away from you, my hands going into my pockets as I examine the quality of your suit. It's very blue. The colour is called navy, Dermot. You sigh, disappointed. Has prison taken away your sarcasm, Michael? I remember you being much more sarcastic 10 years ago. I said as I get back into my car. Nothing can take away my sarcasm, Dermot. You chuckle as you toss your bag into the boot and hop into the passenger seat. So where to, your highness? I say, driving onto the M11. The motorway is seemingly empty of cars, as if God is granting us a moment of privacy. I thought we were going to Mam and Dad's graves to tell them that I'm free. You arch an eyebrow. I've always envied that talent. I never could do it. Of course, but it'll take a while to get there. There is a moment of silence after I say this. We both stare at the road rushing by as I steadily go over the speed limit. The road that will bring us to our parents' graves in Kerry. They always liked Kerry, our mum and dad. The silence is broken when a car rushes past, beeping its horn at me. I wonder why. Maybe it's annoyed that my car is better, who knows. So where is Gwanya? You stare at the road, trying to be casual, America. I'm annoyed she's not here, at her older brother's first day of freedom. She is always good at easing the tension. Car is silent again. You are contemplating this, rolling it around in your mind. You tap your fingers against the dashboard in agitation. I admit I was surprised it was you who came. I thought you weren't spending time to acknowledge me in the slightest. The tapping of your fingers increase in tempo. Why? I asked, my eyes on the road. I stopped at a red light and turned to him. Because you supposedly killed Mam and Dad? I never believed that, not in the slightest. That's a lie. I always thought you could kill, just never thought I'd be your parents. Thank you for saying that. Slowly your fingers stop tapping, and then the light goes green and we begin to drive. A few hours later, we're still in the car, but instead of being in Wexford, we're now in Cork. I think we're nearby Bantry Bay, but I'm not too sure. Gwanya or no. She used to love Cork whenever we came down to visit our grandparents during the summer. Remember how we used to call Gwanya the star of the O'Neills when we were younger? Your voice startles me, making me jump. I was starting to like the silence in the car. Did we? I don't remember that. I remember calling her Munchkin or Midget, but never something as nice as that. A tree branch whacks my window. Honestly, I don't, but I have a feeling she hit you whenever you call her that. She had a mean right hook. You rub your jaw. I snigger. You're false for giving her boxing lessons for her 16th birthday. I smirk. Fun times. Looking back on it now, it might not have been the best idea. It was still funny whenever she hit the lads asking her out though. Mam didn't seem to agree, said it wasn't ladylike being able to knock out lads twice her weight. Might not have helped her that Mam saw Dad give us all high fives for teaching her. My mother had quite the set of lungs. Once again, we are alone on the road. My car races down the tree-lined avenue. My fingers start tapping to the beat coming from the radio. Do you know why she went to America? He said, quietly humming. She said she wanted to start again, try for a new life away from Ireland. I lowered the volume down in the radio to better hear you. Did she say why she wanted to try for a new life? No. I glance at the radio, trying to get the music back. The opening bars of Summer startle me, coming out much too loudly. I quickly lower the volume. We come to a red light and I turn to look at you. You glance away. I turn back to the road and we continue on our way to our parents' graves. We finally reach the graveyard just as the sun begins to set. The graveyard is an eerie place, surrounded by large stone walls, and the only way to enter is through a large iron gate with two watchtowers at either end. We get out of the car and move toward the imposing iron gates. I push open the gate, it creaks. As we pass the numerous headstones of the various deceased, I can't help but feel a chill in the air. I shiver. I've never liked graveyards. I've always wondered why Mom and Dad wanted to be buried here, surrounded by strangers. After a few minutes of silent walking, we reach our parents' graves. As you get down on your knees and lean towards the graves, I take a quick look at the marble headstones. Usheen Owen O'Neill, September 18, 1970 to October 31st, 2006. Here lies a loving father, caring brother, and beloved son and musician. Niamh Aoife O'Neill, December 26, 1969 to October 31st, 2006. Here lies a loving mother, a wonderful sister, and beloved daughter and musician. I take a step back to give you some privacy. Yet I still hear snatches of what you say to them. I am so sorry. Believe in me. We'll do it soon. After a minute, you slowly get back to your feet. You have tear stains down your face. Your hand goes up and wipes them away. You always hated appearing weak. Are you ready to go back? I say, my voice quiet. All you do is nod. You walk back together in silence. You glance at me, trying to figure out something. I pretend not to notice. After a while, you finally speak up. You seem tired. Would you like me to drive you to a hotel or something? I yawn and nod. When I get back to my BMW, I hop to your passenger seat and drive off in search for a good hotel. I had fallen asleep. I realized this as I woke up as you stopped the car in a field. Why did you stop here, I ask, as you open the door and get out. I unbuckled and followed you out. It's a chilly night, with little light coming from above. Just wanted to stretch my legs, you say, rolling your shoulders. So where are we? I ask as I crack my back. Somewhere in Tipperary. We pass a sign a few miles back saying, welcome to Bossier Henry. As I straighten my back, I gasp and feel something cold slide into my skin. I turn around to see you standing there, a bloody blade held loosely in your left hand. Why? I choke out, betrayal shining in my eyes. All you do is glare hatefully at me. You heard my confession at our parents' graves, no? You're still glaring at me. You could always hold a grudge. What confession? Suddenly, I realize I'm feeling rather lightheaded. The one where I told them that their murderer was free. You frown, contemplative. You start to tap the dagger you stabbed me with against your leg. Ah, maybe I didn't need to stab you. No, really, I hadn't thought about that. Apparently, when one is dying, they lose their inhibition to be polite. So what will Grania think about having a murderer for her brother? I don't care what she will think because she won't know that it was I who killed you. Either way, I wanted Grania to be here, not you. You were supposed to have died in the fire I set up to kill our dearest parents. You say the last two words with so much mocking and contempt I'm surprised you're not speaking. Anyway, who did you convince to fake all the evidence saying you didn't murder Mom and Dad? My breathing is ragged, coming out in pants. Never knew being stabbed in the back hurt so much. Do you honestly think I'm going to tell you? You smirk, amused, but the hatred still shines brightly in your eyes. You twirl the dagger between your fingers as casually as most people eat an apple. Although I must say, I was very touched when you said that you never believed I killed them. Your smirk turns into laughter. I never knew you were such a good liar. I had a good teacher, I mutter, as I try to lean on my car for support. I'm pretty sure you stabbed a good few arteries considering the amount of blood pooling at my feet. I'm beginning to smell flowers. It's rather ironic, your place of death, you know. You stare up at the sky, trying to find your favourite constellation. You smile. We are in Bossier Henry, the death of the king. You know the myths as well as I do, that our supposed ancestor Hugh O'Neill ruled all of Ulster and a bit of Connacht as the High King. How apt that you, a descendant of a king, die in Bossier Henry. Instead of leaning against the car, I fall onto the ground. The smell of flowers that I cannot name surround us as you stand above me. A sadistic smile on your face. I stare into your eyes. I see no remorse. You lean forward and spit on me. You've killed me. As my eyelids close for the last time, I hear you say, here lies Dermot O'Neill, a hated brother, an awful son, and a ridiculous man. At least I went out with style. I'm not too sure you heard, but I'm glad I got the last word.
Amazing stuff altogether.
Yes, indeed. But unfortunately, that's all we have for you today. I hope we got to your story or poem. If we didn't, there's always next week.
Don't forget to check out Tales of the Dark Pool's Facebook page and the Near FM website for full details of the series. And you can download a podcast of this program.
We hope you enjoyed today's show.
And will join us at the same time next week on Tales from the Dark Pool's broadcast here on Near FM.
Today's Tale from the Dark Pool program was produced by Enda M. Roach and is a Pearlman Media production for Near FM.
So from myself, Megan Niverini-Aylon,
and myself, Adam Corr,
until next week,
slán go fóill.